You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Last show, we were looking at the chapter, What's Yours is Mine, looking at Uber and other similar services in various cities around the world and what the impact has been. Universal access is one of the tenets of most taxi systems. Cities mandate that taxi services provide a quota of child-friendly vehicles, vehicles suitable for disabled passengers, vehicles that can accommodate service dogs, and meet other universal access requirements. Municipal governments mean that cities such as Toronto can demand that an entire taxi fleet must be wheelchair accessible over the next decade. As new concerns appear, cities can address them, and as London's introduction of zero-emission vehicles to address environmental concerns. In many cities, the taxi industry is rather slow to change. But the fact that taxis are managed at the city level does mean that service can be tuned for the demands and traditions of each city, so that taxis have become iconic in cities such as New York and London. The taxi service is just one part of a larger traffic management problem that cities continuously struggle with, and municipal governance allows it to be balanced with other parts of the urban transit landscape, such as bus services and subway services, and to fit in with other management techniques such as congestion charging. The sheer number of cities around the world also means that transit innovations can be and are imitated from city to city, such as the municipal car sharing and bike sharing programs that have blossomed in cities around the world over the last decade. From balancing consumer and driver interests, to providing predictable pricing, to ensuring individual cars are safe, and the system as a whole fits into the puzzle that is urban traffic. There is more to transit than the simple market exchange. Enter Uber. The investors in Uber clearly believe that it is not destined to be one player among many in the taxi space. They believe that the economics of digital technologies will make Uber the clear winner, not only in the taxi services, but in deliveries and other related work. Not everyone believes that the winner-take-all nature of digital technologies will extend to Uber, which after all is only partially technological. There is certainly competition at the global level, in particular Asian competitors to Uber, who have grown very quickly. Didi, Qiandi in China has raised $3.4 billion, and both Ola in India and Grab Taxi in Singapore and Indonesia has raised over $500 million. But the evidence to date and the basis of many of the investment bets is that the market favors the big, especially within a city. That's one reason why Uber CEO Travis Kalanick admitted to undermining the fundraising efforts of his main competitor, Lyft. The ride-sharing model is a two-sided marketplace in which Uber manages the supply of both riders and drivers. The more riders on the platform, the better it is for drivers. The more drivers available, the better it is for riders. Getting this spiral kick-started is one of the challenges in any new entrant seeking to gain entrance. The technology component of the business is amortized over all the cities in which Uber operates, so its success in New York helps its business in San Diego. If the ride-sharing market is indeed winner-take-all, then restructuring the transit system to accommodate Uber, allowing them to operate without the expenses and regulations to which taxi companies are subjected, amounts to handing over the taxi market to the company. So what kind of a city would we live in with Uber at the wheel? During 2014 and 2015, Uber made a series of claims about the money earned by its drivers. The tale of these claims, not unlike those told by Airbnb, not one of direct lies, but it is one of continual exaggeration, selection, and distortion, which have steadily lost credibility over the last couple of years. The story really starts in May 2014 when the company posted a claim on the Uber website that the median annual income for its UberX driver was $90,766 in New York City and $74,191 in San Francisco. The claim was greeted with an unskeptical enthusiasm by many commentators. Most predominantly, Matt McFarland of the Washington Post led with the headline, quote, "Uber's remarkable growth could end the era of poorly paid cab drivers," unquote. McFarland noted that the typical cab driver's salary is about $30,000. So the difference, it seems, as he put it, was simply astounding. As the story spread, many others jumped on the good news headline. CNBC led with, quote, "Uber's 90K salary could disrupt the taxi business," unquote. Entrepreneur.com claimed, quote, "The median income for an Uber driver in New York City is nearly $100,000," unquote. From the technology industry, CEO Mike Jones laid it out at a Code conference, quote, "You're qualified to drive a car, but not professionally doing it. Congratulations, boom, you're making a $90,000 a year average Uber salary." For many economists, the story was simple and the villain was clear. Regulatory capture by those taxi medallion owners who suck all the money out of the taxi system without delivering value. Take them out of the picture, improve efficiency by better matching drivers with customers to cut down on the dead time between rides, and we have a new age for urban transit. Over time, however, what Uber left out of its numbers was to prove as illuminating as what it included. The Washington Post did mention in the body of its text that the figure was a median of drivers working over 40 hours per week. And if that's the sample, then, as financial journalist Felix Solomon pointed out, quote, "The median number of hours worked for the drivers in this sample is going to be well over 40 hours a week. He continued attempts to get clarification from Uber, but that fell on deaf ears. And then there's the matter that, as McFarland wrote, quote, Uber's numbers don't account for the costs a driver incurs to own and operate a vehicle. Like many people, McFarland thought these costs could not be big enough to make serious difference to the picture. Taxi earnings and employment models vary greatly from city to city, but comparing Uber's estimates to taxi reports from Los Angeles, San Diego, and Toronto shows that Uber's 20% cut of the fare, plus its $1 safety fee, was about the same as that taken by Medallion owners. There was no magic here after all. Payments for gas, maintenance, car depreciation, and insurance, together with additional expenses, including tolls, parking, etc., accounted for about half of each dollar of taxi fare, which would take the earnings down to more like $45,000 in New York and $37,000 in San Francisco. Uber did not choose New York City and San Francisco at random for their report. The company selected these two specific cities because that's where Uber drivers earn the most. In a later report, it was showed that New York City earnings were 50% more than those in any other city except San Francisco, which was comfortably in second place. So in many cities, the earnings would come to about $30,000, which is about the same as the average for a taxi driver. Once additional expenses are accounted for, the astonishing gap between Uber earnings and taxi earnings vanished. Since Uber made its $90,000 claim, it has become less and less plausible. Journalists looking for drivers making $90,000 called their efforts a search for Uber's unicorn, and many of them came up empty-handed. The company never backed up its claims with more complete data or addressed the question of expenses. The year 2014 saw Uber drivers protesting over low income in Seattle in April and August, San Francisco in May and October, Los Angeles in September, New York in September and October, and London in October. An unlikely development if they were earning as much as the company suggested. Low incomes became a consistent complaint on active Uber driver forums at uberpeople.net and Reddit. Reports from individual Uber drivers failed to come up anywhere near the income figures that Uber claimed. When Uber expands to a new city, it provides subsidies and specific offers to drivers and customers to get the service kick-started. As it becomes established, Uber takes a bigger slice of each dollar and often cuts fares. Over time, Uber has taken a larger and larger slice of every fare. In April 2014, Uber introduced a $1 per trip safety fee, increasing the company's slice to around 30% for short trips. In July, it started charging drivers $10 per week for the use of a smartphone. In September, Uber increased their commission for new drivers in San Francisco to 25% of the fare, and in May 2014, they started experimenting with taking 30% of the fare, more than most Medallion owners take. Before this most recent trial, Uber CFO Brent Kalanikos mentioned in a meeting with potential investors that Uber could easily raise rates to between 25 and 30%. Venture capitalist Mike Novogratz asked him a question, quote, you've got happy employees, you've got happy customers, you've got happy shareholders. The holy triumvirate are all really excited about your company. Why are you going to risk that and push the employee's salary down 5%? Kalinikos responded, because we can. When it cuts prices, Uber insists that it's good for drivers, that a greater number of rides per driver makes up for the price cuts. In October 2014, it put some numbers behind those claims. In a company blog post, Uber showed that it cuts fares in New York City, the average gross hourly earnings of drivers increased from $25 in 2012 to $27 in 2013 to $36 in 2014, before Uber's take or other deductions. The 2014 rate, after Uber's take and after taxes, but before any driver expenses, was around $25 per hour. As an aside, at that rate, a driver would have to work 70 hours a week every week of the year to bring in $90,000. Drivers were busy more of the time, so although each fare was less, their total income increased. Again, however, a key piece of data needed to provide a realistic estimate of actual income is missing. In this case, the number of miles that a driver puts on the clock. More rides obviously means more gas and more wear and tear on each driver's car. Data about driver expenses was also missing from a report commissioned by the company, written by eminent economist Alan Krueger and Uber head of policy research, Jonathan Hall. Their main conclusions were that Uber is growing rather quickly, impressive but no surprise, and that Uber drivers are paid better than taxi drivers. They report earnings of $30 per hour for New York, although more modest in other cities, $19 per hour in Boston, $17 in Los Angeles, and compare them to government figures showing that taxi drivers take in about 30% less on average. As with previous Uber reports, Krueger and Hall shrugged their shoulders at these expenses. A detailed qualification of driver partner costs and net after-tax earnings is a topic for future research. Nevertheless, the figure suggests that unless their after-tax costs average more than $6 per hour, the net hourly earnings of Uber's driver partners exceed the hourly wage of employed taxi drivers and chauffeurs on average. Several commentators picked up on the gap. A remarkable estimate is not that it is difficult to make if you know the distance driven, which Uber obviously does, as it tracks all the cars on its system. Washington Post journalist Andrea Peterson writes, quote, "The Internal Revenue Service sets standard mileage rates for tax purposes. For 2015, taxpayers can deduct 57.5 cents a mile for operating a car for business purposes. That rate is based on the annual study of the costs of vehicle operation. These things like repairs, insurance, maintenance, gas, and depreciation that were not factored into Uber's study."
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Based on this figure, Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research estimated that the average length of a drive would have to be considerably less than 8 miles for Uber drivers to come out ahead of traditional cab drivers. Baker also notes that if Uber drivers do not pay for commercial insurance, or they do not invest in the upkeep of their cars to the extent that commercial drivers are expected to, they would have, in fact, fewer expenses and more take-home pay. If that's the case, it would be a typical story of getting rich in the new economy. Find a way to get around the rules and claim it as a great innovation. We do have one other source of information about driver pay, which is, of course, the drivers themselves. One of the most multifaceted and careful is an account by Philadelphia journalist Emily Grudelberger of her time as an Uber driver. After meticulously tracking her own expenses and those of other drivers who shared them with her, she made about $17 per hour gross. And after Uber's 28% cut and the 19% that went to expenses, she ended up with just $9.34 an hour. Uber is not going to end the era of poorly paid cab drivers anytime soon, apparently. If the pay is really so poor, why do so many people drive for Uber? For those who have a car, driving for Uber is a way of converting that capital into cash. Some underestimate the costs involved with full-time driving. For some, the flexibility is a boon. For many, driving for Uber offers what taxi drivers' driving has offered for years. A job that requires little skill and has low cost of entry is better than nothing. And as Uber has cut into the demand for taxis in many cities, individual taxi driver incomes have fallen, leaving Uber as the best alternative. This discussion of Uber driver income only touches the surface of what is a complex and ever-evolving topic. But what comes out of this is what the real story is, a long way from the $90,000, even though that number is still out there. Grudelberger refers to that $90,000 a year figure that so many passengers asked about. Uber drivers appear to take home about the same as a taxi driver once expenses are all figured in, while Uber itself has stepped in and it takes as much of the fare as do medallion holders. One of the complaints that taxi companies have against Uber and Lyft is that they are subject to different standards and that taxi standards are more onerous than those of the ride-sharing companies have to follow. Uber maintains that its drivers are subject to a thorough screening process, but a series of assaults on the service has put this largely automated process under scrutiny. It has not held up well. Most dramatically, The Guardian worked with a whistleblower who applied for work as a driver with Uber UK. Part of the process is to upload car insurance documents. The whistleblower uploaded the fake insurance policy using a made-up insurance company, free cover, but Uber still approved him to drive. Another driver said that some drivers photocopy the documents. And in U.S. drivers have claimed that it is easy to get around the screening by driving on someone else's account. District attorneys in California have filed a complaint claiming, quote, systematic failures in Uber's background check process, so that registered sex offenders, identity thieves, burglars, kidnappers, and a convicted murderer passed the firm's screening process and were in fact driving for the company. There have been numerous cases of assault on both Uber drivers and passengers, but taxi driving is dangerous too, and there's also cases of assault by taxi drivers. The difference between the two is that there is a mechanism for people or communities to demand better of taxi companies and to hold them accountable. Uber maintains that while safety is what safety is, they never forget to say, always its highest priority, the drivers are not Uber employees, and Uber is not responsible for what happens on the ride. The same story can be told of car safety standards. Uber has adjusted its policies in different cities when it has come under pressure. In Toronto, for example, it introduced an inspection by certified mechanics as the debate about the service grew in profile. The city inspects taxis every 6 months. But again, the company can unilaterally change its standards when it wants. For example, in February 2015, it increased the maximum age of UberX cars to 15 years in many major markets. One of the reasons for regulation in many cities is to ensure universal access to the city's transport system. Two common requirements of taxi services are that they have to cover all areas of the city, and they have to be ready to transport anyone without discrimination, including people with disabilities. The reactions to Uber from different segments of the population tell a complex story of how taxis and Uber fit into the overall urban environment. In California, when the company was certified as a transportation network company, the regulators required the TNCs, which provide paid rides mostly for freelance drivers using their own cars, to submit reports on how they will accommodate disabled users. Disability rights advocates Larry Paradis commented that, quote, the plans are all quite tentative and don't address the fundamental challenge, which is ensuring enough accessible vehicles to make the transportation system at least minimally accessible for people with mobility disabilities. Since then, Uber and other TNCs have made little progress in addressing the issue of universal access, and disabled groups and individuals have been vocal in their opinion that these services are not living up to the standard of universal access. We're going to be looking at this and other issues with ride-sharing companies like Uber and so on, and looking at the other aspects of the sharing economy and future shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Cette station, ainsi que les plus de 250 autres stations similaires à travers le pays, ont besoin de votre soutien. Jour après jour, elle vous informe sur les sujets qui comptent, diffuse une musique que vous n'entendrez nulle part ailleurs et font partie intégrante de cette communauté. Vous pouvez vous assurer qu'elles obtiennent le financement dont elles ont besoin pour se développer en vous rendant sur monirc.ca. Vous y trouverez tous les détails concernant l'initiative des radios communautaires. Une fois sur monirc.ca, il ne vous faudra que 5 minutes et quelques clics pour signer une pétition, générer une lettre